Chapter 18. A Finer Tradition. The Resistance of the Rational. I am thus one of the very few examples in this country of one who has not thrown off religious belief, but never had it. This point in my early education had, however, incidentally, one bad consequence, deserving notice. In giving me an opinion contrary to that of the world, my father thought it necessary to give it as one which could not prudently be avowed to the world. This lesson of keeping my thoughts to myself, at that early age, was attended with some moral disadvantages. John Stuart Mill, Autobiography. Le silence éternel de ces espaces infinis m'effraie. The eternal silence of these infinite spaces makes me afraid. Blaise Pascal, Pensée. The Book of Psalms can be deceiving. The celebrated opening of Psalm 121, for example, I shall lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help, is rendered in English as a statement, but in the original takes the form of a question, where is the help coming from? Never fear, the glib answer is that the believers will be immune from all danger and suffering. Whoever the psalmist turns out to have been, he was obviously pleased enough with the polish and address of Psalm 14 to repeat it, virtually word for word, as Psalm 53. Both versions begin with the identical statement that, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. For some reason, this null remark is considered significant enough to be recycled throughout all religious apologetics. All that we can tell for sure from the otherwise meaningless assertion is that unbelief, not just heresy and backsliding, but unbelief, must have been known to exist even in that remote epoch. Given the then absolute rule of unchallenged and brutally punitive faith, it would perhaps have been a fool who did not keep this conclusion buried deep inside himself, in which case it would be interesting to know how the psalmist knew it was there. Dissidents used to be locked up in Soviet lunatic asylums for reformist delusions, it being quite naturally and reasonably assumed that anybody mad enough to propose reforms had lost all sense of self-preservation. Our species will never run out of fools, but I dare say that there have been at least as many credulous idiots who professed faith in God as there have been dolts and simpletons who concluded otherwise. It might be immodest to suggest that the odds rather favour the intelligence and curiosity of the atheists, but it is the case that some humans have always noticed the improbability of God, the evil done in his name, the likelihood that he is man-made, and the availability of less harmful alternative beliefs and explanations. We cannot know the names of all these men and women because they have in all times and at all places been subject to ruthless repression. For the identical reason, nor can we know how many ostensibly devout people were secretly unbelievers. As late as the 18th and 19th centuries, in relatively free societies such as Britain and the United States, unbelievers as secure and prosperous as James Mill and Benjamin Franklin felt it advisable to keep their opinions private. Thus, when we read of the glories of Christian devotional painting and architecture, or Islamic astronomy and medicine, we are talking about advances of civilization and culture, some of them anticipated by Aztecs and Chinese, that have as much to do with faith as their predecessors had to do with human sacrifice and imperialism. And we have no means of knowing, except in a very few special cases, how many of these architects and painters and scientists were preserving their innermost thoughts from the scrutiny of the godly. Galileo might have been unmolested in his telescopic work if he had not been so unwise as to admit that it had cosmological implications. Doubt, scepticism, and outright unbelief have always taken the same essential form as they do today. There were always observations on the natural order which took notice of the absence or needlessness of a prime mover. There were always shrewd comments on the way in which religion reflected human wishes or human designs. It was never that difficult to see that religion was a cause of hatred and conflict, and that its maintenance depended upon ignorance and superstition. Satirists and poets, as well as philosophers and men of science, were capable of pointing out that if triangles had gods, their gods would have three sides, just as Thracian gods had blonde hair and blue eyes. The original collision between our reasoning faculties and any form of organized faith, though it must have occurred before in the minds of many, is probably exemplified in the trial of Socrates in 399 BC. It does not matter at all to me that we have no absolute certainty that Socrates even existed. The records of his life and his words are second-hand, almost, but not quite as much, as are the books of the Jewish and Christian Bible and the Hadiths of Islam. Philosophy, however, has no need of such demonstrations because it does not deal in revealed wisdom. As it happens, we have some plausible accounts of the life in question. A Stoic soldier, somewhat resembling Schweik in appearance, a shrewish wife, a tendency to attacks of catalepsy, and these will do. On the word of Plato, who was perhaps an eyewitness, we may accept that during a time of paranoia and tyranny in Athens, Socrates was indicted for godlessness and knew his life to be forfeit. The noble words of the apology also make it plain that he did not care to save himself by affirming, like a later man faced with an inquisition, anything that he did not believe. Even though he was not in fact an atheist, he was quite correctly considered unsound for his advocacy of free thought and unrestricted inquiry, and his refusal to give assent to any dogma. All he really knew, he said, was the extent of his own ignorance. This, to me, is still the definition of an educated person. According to Plato, this great Athenian was quite content to observe the customary rites of the city, testified that the Delphic oracle had instructed him to become a philosopher, and on his deathbed, condemned to swallow the hemlock, spoke of a possible afterlife in which those who had thrown off the world by mental exercise might yet continue to lead an existence of pure mind. But even then he remembered, as always, to qualify himself by adding that this might well not be the case. The question, as always, was worth pursuing. Philosophy begins where religion ends, just as by analogy chemistry begins where alchemy runs out and astronomy takes the place of astrology. From Socrates also we can learn how to argue two things that are of the highest importance. The first is that conscience is innate. The second is that the dogmatic faithful can easily be outpointed and satirized by one who pretends to take their preachings at face value. Socrates believed that he had a daemon, or oracle, or internal guide whose good opinion was worth having. Everybody but the psychopath has this feeling to a greater or lesser extent. Adam Smith described a permanent partner in an inaudible conversation, who acted as a check and scrutineer. Sigmund Freud wrote that the voice of reason was small but very persistent. C.S. Lewis tried to prove too much by opining that the presence of a conscience indicated the divine spark. Modern vernacular describes conscience not too badly, as whatever it is that makes us behave well when nobody's looking. At any event, Socrates absolutely refused to say anything of which he was not morally sure. He would sometimes, if he suspected himself of casuistry or crowd-pleasing, break off in the very middle of a speech. He told his judges that at no point in his closing plea had his oracle hinted at him to stop. Those who believe that the existence of conscience is a proof of a godly design are advancing an argument that simply cannot be disproved because there is no evidence for or against it. The case of Socrates, however, demonstrates that men and women of real conscience will often have to assert it against faith. He was facing death but had the option, even if convicted, of a lesser sentence if he chose to plead for it. In almost insulting tones, he offered to pay a negligible fine instead. Having thus given his angry judges no alternative but the supreme penalty, he proceeded to explain why murder at their hands was meaningless to him. Death had no terror. It was either perpetual rest or the chance of immortality, and even of communion with great Greeks like Orpheus and Homer, who had predeceased him. In such a happy case, he observed dryly, one might even wish to die and die again. It need not matter to us that the Delphic oracle is no more, and that Orpheus and Homer are mythical. The point is that Socrates was mocking his accusers in their own terms, saying in effect, I do not know for certain about death and the gods, but I am as certain as I can be that you do not know either. Some of the anti-religious effects of Socrates and his gentle but relentless questioning can be gauged from a play that was written and performed in his own lifetime. The Clouds, composed by Aristophanes, features a philosopher named Socrates who keeps up a school of skepticism. A nearby farmer manages to come up with all the usual dull questions asked by the faithful. For one thing, if there is no Zeus, who brings the rain to water the crops? Inviting the man to use his head for a second, Socrates points out that if Zeus could make it rain, there would or could be rain from cloudless skies. Since this does not happen, it might be wiser to conclude that the clouds are the cause of the rainfall. All right, then, says the farmer, who moves the clouds into position? That must surely be Zeus. Not so, says Socrates, who explains about winds and heat. Well, in that case, replies the old rustic, where does the lightning come from, to punish liars and other wrongdoers? The lightning, it is gently pointed out to him, doesn't seem to discriminate between the just and the unjust. Indeed, it has often been noticed to strike the temples of Olympian Zeus himself. This is enough to win the farmer over, though he later recants his impiety and burns down the school with Socrates inside it. Many are the freethinkers who have gone the same way, or escaped very narrowly. All major confrontations over the right to free thought, free speech, and free inquiry have taken the same form, of a religious attempt to assert the literal and limited mind over the ironic and inquiring one. In essence, the argument with faith begins and ends with Socrates, and you may, if you wish, take the view that the city prosecutors did right in protecting Athenian youth from his troublesome speculations. However, it cannot be argued that he brought much science to bear against superstition. one of his prosecutors alleged that he had called the sun a piece of stone and the moon a piece of earth, the latter of which would have been true, but Socrates turned aside the charge, saying that it was a problem for Anaxagoras. This Ionian philosopher had in fact been prosecuted earlier for saying that the sun was a red-hot piece of rock and the moon a piece of earth, but he was not as insightful as Leucippus and Democritus, who proposed that everything was made of atoms in perpetual motion. Incidentally, it's also quite possible that Leucippus never existed, and nothing important depends on whether or not he actually did. The important thing about the brilliant atomist school is that it regarded the question of first cause or origin as essentially irrelevant. At the time, this was as far as any mind could reasonably go. This left the problem of the gods unresolved. Epicurus, who took up the theory of Democritus concerning atoms, could not quite disbelieve in their existence, but he did find it impossible to convince himself that the gods played any role in human affairs. For one thing, why would they bother with the tedium of human existence, let alone the tedium of human government? They avoid unnecessary pain, and humans are wise to do likewise. Thus there is nothing to be feared in death, and in the meantime, all attempts to read the gods' intentions, such as studying the entrails of animals, are an absurd waste of time. In some ways, the most attractive and the most charming of the founders of anti-religion is the poet Lucretius, who lived in the first century before Christ, and admired the work of Epicurus beyond measure. Reacting to a revival of ancient worship by the Emperor Augustus, he composed a witty and brilliant poem entitled De Rerum Natura, or On the Nature of Things. This work was nearly destroyed by Christian fanatics in the Middle Ages, and only one printed manuscript survived, so we are fortunate even to know that a person writing in the time of Cicero, who first published the poem, and Julius Caesar, had managed to keep alive the atomic theory. Lucretius anticipated David Hume in saying that the prospect of future annihilation was no worse than the contemplation of the nothingness from which one came, and also anticipated Freud in ridiculing the idea of prearranged burial rites and memorials, all of them expressing the vain and useless wish to be present in some way at one's own funeral. Following Aristophanes, he thought that the weather was its own explanation, and that nature, rid of all gods, did the work that foolish and self-centered people imagined to be divinely inspired, or directed at their puny selves. Who can wheel all the starry spheres and blow over all land the fruitful warmth from above, be ready in all places and all times, gather black clouds and shake the quiet sky with terrible thunder, to hurl down bolts which often rattle his own shrines, to rage in the desert, retreating for target drill, so that his shafts can pass the guilty by and slay the innocent? Atomism was viciously persecuted throughout Christian Europe for many centuries, on the not unreasonable ground that it offered a far better explanation of the natural world than did religion. But like a tenuous thread of thought, the work of Lucretius managed to persist in a few learned minds. Sir Isaac Newton may have been a believer in all sorts of pseudo-science as well as in Christianity, but when he came to set out his Principia, he included 90 lines of De Rerum Natura in the early drafts. Galileo's 1623 volume Saggiatori, while it does not acknowledge Epicurus, was so dependent on his atomic theories that both its friends and its critics referred to it as an Epicurean book. In view of the terror imposed by religion on science and scholarship throughout the early Christian centuries, Augustine maintained that the pagan gods did exist, but only as devils, and that the earth was less than 6,000 years old, and the fact that most intelligent people found it prudent to make an outward show of conformity, one need not be surprised that the revival of philosophy was often expressed in quasi-devout terms. Those who followed the various schools of philosophy that were permitted in Andalusia during its brief flowering, a synthesis between Aristotelianism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, were permitted to speculate about duality and truth, and a possible balance between reason and revelation. This concept of double truth was advanced by supporters of Averroes, but strongly opposed by the Church for obvious reasons. Francis Bacon, writing during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, liked to say, perhaps following Tertullian's assertion, that the greater the absurdity, the stronger his belief in it, that faith is at its greatest when its teachings are least amenable to reason. Pierre Bayle, writing a few decades later, was fond of stating all the claims of reason against a given belief, only to add, "So much the greater is the triumph of faith in nevertheless believing." We can be fairly sure that he did not do this merely in order to escape punishment. The time when irony would punish and confuse the literal and the fanatical was about to dawn. But this was not to happen without many revenges and rearguard actions from the literal and the fanatical. For a brief but splendid time in the 17th century, the staunch little nation of Holland was the tolerant host of many freethinkers, such as Bayle, who moved there to be safe, and René Descartes, who moved there for the same reason. It was also the birthplace, 1 year before the arraignment of Galileo by the Inquisition, of the great Baruch Spinoza, a son of the Spanish and Portuguese Jewry who had themselves originally emigrated to Holland to be free of persecution. On July 27, 1656, the elders of the Amsterdam synagogue made the following harem, or damnation, or fatwa, concerning his work. With the judgment of the angels and of the saints, we excommunicate, cut off, curse, and anathematize Baruch de Espinosa, with the consent of the elders and of all this holy congregation, in the presence of the holy books, by the 613 precepts which are written therein, with the anathema wherewith Joshua cursed Jericho, with the curse which Elisha laid upon the children, and with all the curses which are written in the law. Cursed be he by day, and cursed be he by night. Cursed be he in sleeping, and cursed be he in waking. Cursed in going out, and cursed in coming in. The Lord shall not pardon him. The wrath and fury of the Lord shall henceforth be kindled against this man, and shall lay upon him all the curses which are written in the book of the law. The Lord shall destroy his name under the sun, and cut him off for his undoing from all the tribes of Israel, with all the curses of the firmament which are written in the book of the law. This multiple malediction concluded with an order requiring all Jews to avoid any contact with Spinoza and to refrain on pain of punishment from reading any paper composed or written by him. Incidentally, the curse which Elisha laid upon the children refers to the highly elevating biblical story in which Elisha, annoyed by children who teased him for his baldness, called upon God to send some she-bears to rend the children limb from limb, which, so says the story, the bears dutifully did. Perhaps Thomas Paine was not wrong in saying that he could not believe in any religion that shocked the mind of a child. The Vatican and the Calvinist authorities in Holland heartily approved of this hysterical Jewish condemnation and joined in the Europe-wide suppression of all Spinoza's work. Had the man not questioned the immortality of the soul and called for the separation of church and state? Away with him! This derided heretic is now credited with the most original philosophical work ever done on the mind-body distinction, and his meditations on the human condition have provided more real consolation to thoughtful people than has any religion. Argument continues about whether Spinoza was an atheist. It now seems odd that we should have to argue as to whether pantheism is atheism or not. In its own expressed terms, it is actually theistic, but Spinoza's definition of a god made manifest throughout the natural world comes very close to defining a religious god out of existence. And if there is a pervasive pre-existing cosmic deity who is part of what he creates, then there is no space left for a god who intervenes in human affairs, let alone for a god who takes sides in vicious Hamlet wars between different tribes of Jews and Arabs. No text can have been written or inspired by him, for one thing, or can be the special property of one sect or tribe. One recalls the question that was asked by the Chinese when the first Christian missionaries made their appearance. If God has revealed himself, how is it that he has allowed so many centuries to elapse before informing the Chinese? Seek knowledge even if it is in China, said the Prophet Muhammad, unconsciously revealing that the greatest civilization in the world at that time was on the very outer rim of his awareness. As with Newton and Galileo building on Democritus and Epicurus, we find Spinoza projected forward into the mind of Einstein, who answered a question from a rabbi by stating firmly that he believed only in Spinoza's God, and not at all in a God who concerns himself with the fates and actions of human beings. Spinoza de-Judaized his name by changing it to Benedict, outlasted the Amsterdam anathema by 20 years, and died with extreme stoicism, always persisting in calm and rational conversation, as a consequence of the powdered glass that entered his lungs. His was a career devoted to the grinding and polishing of lenses for telescopes and medicine, an appropriate scientific activity for one who taught humans to see with greater acuity. All our modern philosophers, wrote Heinrich Heine, though often perhaps unconsciously, see through the glasses which Baruch Spinoza ground. Heine's poems were later to be thrown on a pyre by gibbering Nazi bully boys who did not believe that even an assimilated Jew could have been a true German. The frightened backward Jews who ostracized Spinoza had thrown away a pearl richer than all their tribe. The body of their bravest son was stolen after his death, and no doubt subjected to other rituals of desecration. Spinoza had seen some of this coming. In his correspondence he would write the word caute, Latin for take care, and place a little rose underneath. This was not the only aspect of his work that was sub rosa. He gave a false name for the printer of his celebrated Tractatus, and left the author's page blank. His prohibited work, much of which might not have survived his death if not for the bravery and initiative of a friend, continued to have a subterranean existence in the writing of others. In Pierre Bayle's 1697 critical Dictionnaire, he earned the longest entry. Montesquieu's 1748 Spirit of the Laws was considered so dependent on Spinoza's writing that its author was compelled by the church authorities in France to repudiate this Jewish monster, and to make a public statement announcing his belief in a Christian creator. The great French Encyclopédie that came to define the Enlightenment, edited by Tennis Diderot and D'Alembert, contains an immense entry on Spinoza. I do not wish to repeat the gross mistake that Christian apologists have made. They expended huge and needless effort to show that wise men who wrote before Christ were in effect prophets and prefigurations of his coming. As late as the 19th century, William Ewart Gladstone covered reams of wasted paper trying to prove this about the ancient Greeks. I have no right to claim past philosophers as putative ancestors of atheism. I do, however, have the right to point out that because of religious intolerance, we cannot know what they really thought privately, and were very nearly prevented from learning what they wrote publicly. Even the relatively conformist Descartes, who found it advisable to live in the freer atmosphere of the Netherlands, proposed a few lapidary words for his own headstone. He who hid well, lived well. In the cases of Pierre Bayle and Voltaire, for example, it is not easy to determine whether they were seriously irreligious or not. Their methods certainly tended to be irreverent and satirical, and no reader clinging to uncritical faith could come away from their works without having that faith severely shaken. These same works were the best sellers of their time, and made it impossible for the newly literate classes to go on believing in things like the literal truth of the biblical stories. Bayle in particular caused a huge but wholesome uproar when he examined the deeds of David, the supposed psalmist, and showed them to be the career of an unscrupulous bandit. He also pointed out that it was absurd to believe that religious faith caused people to conduct themselves better, or that unbelief made them behave worse. A vast accumulation of observable experience testified to this common sense, and Bayle's delineation of it is the reason why he has been praised or blamed for a bleak, surreptitious atheism. Yet he accompanied or bodyguarded this with many more orthodox affirmations, which probably allowed his successful work to enjoy a second edition. Voltaire balanced his own savage ridicule of religion with some devotional gestures, and smilingly proposed that his own tomb, how these men did rattle on about the view of their own funerals, be built so as to be half inside and half outside the church. But in one of his most celebrated defences of civil liberty and the rights of conscience, Voltaire had also seen his client, Jean Calas, broken on the wheel with hammers and then hanged for the offence of trying to convert someone in his household to Protestantism. Not even an aristocrat like himself could be counted safe, as he knew from seeing the inside of the Bastille. Let us at least not fail to keep this in mind. Immanuel Kant believed for a time that all the planets were populated and that these populations improved in character the further away they were. But even while beginning from this rather charmingly limited cosmic base, he was able to make convincing arguments against any theistic presentation that depended upon reason. He showed that the old argument from design, then as now a perennial favourite, might possibly be stretched to imply an architect, but not a creator. He overthrew the cosmological proof of God, which suggested that one's own existence must posit another necessary existence, by saying that it only restated the ontological argument. And he undid the ontological argument by challenging the simple-minded notion that if God can be conceived as an idea or stated as a predicate, he must therefore possess the quality of existence. This traditional tripe is accidentally overthrown by Penelope Lively in her much-garlanded novel Moon Tiger. Describing her daughter Lisa as a dull child, she nonetheless delights in the infant's dim but imaginative questions. "Are there dragons?" she asked. I said that there were not. "Have there ever been?" I said all the evidence was to the contrary. "But if there is a word dragon," she said, "then once there must have been dragons." Who has not protected an innocent from the disproof of such ontology? But for the sake of pith, and since we do not have all our lives to waste simply in growing up, I quote Bertrand Russell here. Kant objects that existence is not a predicate. 100 Thalers that I merely imagine, he says, have all the same predicates as 100 real Thalers. I have stated Kant's disproofs in reverse order so as to notice the case recorded by the Inquisition in Venice in 1573 of a man named Matteo de Vincenti, who opined on the doctrine of the real presence of Christ in the Mass that it's nonsense having to believe these things. They're stories. I would rather believe I had money in my pocket. Kant did not know of this predecessor of his among the common people, and when he switched to the more rewarding topic of ethics, he may not have known that his categorical imperative had an echo of Rabbi Hillel's golden rule. Kant's principle enjoins us to act as if the maxim of your action were to become through your will a general natural law. In this summary of mutual interest and solidarity, there's no requirement for any enforcing or supernatural authority, and why should there be? Human decency is not derived from religion, it precedes it. It is of great interest to see in the period of the 18th century Enlightenment how many great minds thought alike and intersected with each other, and also took great care to keep their opinions cautiously expressed or confined as far as possible to a circle of educated sympathisers. One of my choice instances would be that of Benjamin Franklin, who, if he did not exactly discover electricity, was certainly one of those who helped uncover its principles in practical applications. Among the latter were the lightning rod, which was to decide forever the question of whether God intervened to punish us in sudden random flashes. There is no steeple or minaret now standing that does not boast one. Announcing his invention to the public, Franklin wrote, "It has pleased God in his goodness to mankind, at length to discover to them the means of securing their habitations and other buildings from mischief by thunder and lightning. The method is this." He then goes on to elaborate the common household equipment, brass wire, a knitting needle, a few small staples, that is required to accomplish the miracle. This shows perfect outward conformity with received opinion, but is embellished with a small yet obvious dig in the words, "at length." You may choose to believe, of course, that Franklin sincerely meant every word of it, and desired people to believe that he credited the Almighty with relenting after all these years and finally handing over the secret. But the echo of Prometheus stealing the fire from the gods is too plain to miss, and Prometheans in those days still had to be watchful. Joseph Priestley, the virtual discoverer of oxygen, had his Birmingham laboratory smashed by a Tory-inspired mob yelling for church and king, and had to take his Unitarian convictions across the Atlantic in order to begin work again. Nothing is perfect in these accounts. Franklin took as strong an interest in Freemasonry as Newton had in alchemy, and even Priestley was a devotee of the phlogiston theory. Remember that we are examining the childhood of our species. Edward Gibbon, who was revolted by what he discovered about Christianity during the labour of his massive decline and fall of the Roman Empire, dispatched an early copy to David Hume, who warned him that there would be trouble, which there was. Hume received Benjamin Franklin as a guest in Edinburgh and travelled to Paris to meet with the editors of the Encyclopédie. These sometimes flamboyantly irreligious men were at first disappointed when their careful Scottish guest remarked on the absence of atheists, and therefore on the possible absence of such a thing as atheism. They might have liked him better if they had read his dialogue concerning natural religion a decade or so later. Based on a Ciceronian dialogue, with Hume himself apparently but cautiously taking the part of Philo, the traditional arguments about the existence of God are qualified a little by the availability of more modern evidence and reasoning. Borrowing perhaps from Spinoza, much of whose own work was still only available at second hand, Hume suggested that the profession of belief in a perfectly simple and omnipresent supreme being was in fact a covert profession of atheism, because such a being could possess nothing that we could reasonably call a mind or a will. Moreover, if he did chance to possess such attributes, then the ancient inquiry of Epicurus would still stand. Is he willing to prevent evil, but not able? Then is he impotent. Is he able but not willing? Then is he malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Whence then is evil? Atheism cuts through this non-quandary like the razor of Occam. It is absurd even for a believer to imagine that God should owe him an explanation. But a believer nonetheless takes on the impossible task of interpreting the will of a person unknown, and thus brings these essentially absurd questions upon himself. Let the assumption lapse, though, and we shall see where we are, and be able to apply our intelligence, which is all that we have. To the inescapable question, where do all the creatures come from? Hume's answer anticipates Darwin by saying that in effect they evolve. Efficient ones survive, and the inefficient ones die out. At the close, he chose, as had Cicero, to split the difference between the deist Cleanthes and the sceptic Philo. This could have been playing it safe, as Hume tended to do, or it could have represented the apparent appeal of deism in the age before Darwin. Even the great Thomas Paine, a friend to Franklin and Jefferson, repudiated the charge of atheism that he was not afraid to invite. Indeed, he set out to expose the crimes and horrors of the Old Testament as well as the foolish myths of the New as part of a vindication of God. No grand and noble deity, he asserted, should have such atrocities and stupidities laid to his charge. Paine's Age of Reason marks almost the first time that frank contempt for organized religion was openly expressed. It had a tremendous worldwide effect. His American friends and contemporaries, partly inspired by him to declare independence from the Hanoverian usurpers and their private Anglican church, meanwhile achieved an extraordinary and unprecedented thing, the writing of a democratic and republican constitution that made no mention of God, and that mentioned religion only when guaranteeing that it would always be separated from the state. Almost all of the American founders died without any priest by their bedside, as also did Paine, who was much pestered in his last hours by religious hooligans, who demanded that he accept Christ as his saviour. Like David Hume, he declined all such consolation, and his memory has outlasted the calumnious rumour that he begged to be reconciled with the church at the end. The mere fact that such deathbed repentances were sought by the godly, let alone subsequently fabricated, speaks volumes about the bad faith of the faith-based. Charles Darwin was born within the lifetime of Paine and Jefferson, and his work was eventually able to transcend the limitations of ignorance concerning the origin of plants and animals and other phenomena under which they had had to labour. But even Darwin, when he began his quest as a botanist and natural historian, was quite sure that he was acting in a way that was consistent with God's design. He had wanted to be a clergyman, and the more discoveries he made, the more he tried to square them with faith in a higher intelligence. Like Edward Gibbon, he anticipated a controversy upon publication, and, a bit less like Gibbon, he made some protective and defensive notes. In fact, he at first argued with himself very much as some of today's intelligent design boobies are wont to do. Faced with the unarguable facts of evolution, why not claim that those prove how much greater is God than we even thought he was? The discovery of natural laws should exalt our notion of the power of the omniscient Creator. Not quite convinced by this in his own mind, Darwin feared that his first writings on natural selection would be the end of his reputation, equivalent to confessing a murder. He also appreciated that, if he ever found adaptation conforming to environment, he would have to confess to something even more alarming, the absence of a first cause or grand design. The symptoms of old style between the lines encoded concealment are to be found throughout the first edition of The Origin of Species. The term evolution never appears, while the word creation is employed frequently. Fascinatingly, his first 1837 notebooks were given the provisional title The Transmutation of Species, almost as if Darwin were employing the archaic language of alchemy. The title page of the eventual Origin bore a comment, significantly drawn from the apparently respectable Francis Bacon, about the need to study not just the word of God, but also his work. In The Descent of Man, Darwin felt able to push matters a little further, but still submitted to some editorial revisions by his devout and beloved wife Emma. Only in his autobiography, which was not intended for publication, and in some letters to friends, did he admit that he had no remaining belief. His agnostic conclusion was determined as much by his life as by his work. He had suffered many bereavements and could not reconcile these with any loving Creator, let alone with the Christian teaching concerning eternal punishment. Like so many people, however brilliant, he was prone to that solipsism that either makes or breaks faith, which imagines that the universe is preoccupied with one's own fate. This, however, makes his scientific rigour the more praiseworthy and fit to be ranked with Galileo, since it did not arise from any intention but that of finding out the truth. It makes no difference that this intention included the false and disappointed expectation that that same truth would finally resound ad maiorem Dei gloriam. After his death, Darwin too was posthumously insulted by fabrications from a historical Christian, who claimed that the great and honest and tormented investigator had been squinting at the Bible at the last. It took a little while to expose the pathetic fraud who had felt that this would be a noble thing to do. When accused of scientific plagiarism, of which he was quite probably guilty, Sir Isaac Newton made the guarded admission, which was itself plagiarized, that he had, in his work, had the advantage of standing on the shoulders of giants. It would seem only minimally gracious in the first decade of the 21st century to concede the same. As and when I wish, I can use a simple laptop to acquaint myself with the life and work of Anaxagoras and Erasmus, Epicurus and Wittgenstein. Not for me the poring in the library by candlelight, the shortage of texts or the difficulties of contact with like-minded persons in other ages or societies. And not for me, except when the telephone sometimes rings, and I hear hoarse voices condemning me to death or hell or both, the persistent fear that something I write will lead to the extinction of my work, the exile or worse of my family, the eternal blackening of my name by religious frauds and liars, and the painful choice between recantation or death by torture. I enjoy freedom and an access to knowledge that would have been unimaginable to the pioneers. Looking back down the perspective of time, I therefore cannot help but notice that the giants upon whom I depend, and upon whose massive shoulders I perch, were all of them forced to be a little weak in the crucial and highly and poorly evolved joints of their knees. Only one member of the giant and genius category ever truly spoke his mind without any apparent fear or excess of caution. I therefore cite Albert Einstein, so much misrepresented, once again. He is addressing a correspondent who is troubled by yet another of those many misrepresentations. "It was, of course, a lie, what you read about my religious convictions, a lie which is being systematically repeated. I do not believe in a personal God, and I have never denied this, but expressed it clearly. If something is in me which can be called religious, then it is the unbounded admiration for the structure of the world so far as our science can reveal it." Years later, he answered another query by stating, "I do not believe in the immortality of the individual, and I consider ethics to be an exclusively human concern, with no superhuman authority behind it." These words stem from a mind or a man who was rightly famed for his care and measure and scruple, and whose sheer genius had laid bare a theory that might in the wrong hands have obliterated not only this world, but also its whole past and the very possibility of its future. He devoted the greater part of his life to a grand refusal of the role of a punitive prophet, preferring to spread the message of enlightenment and humanism. Decidedly Jewish, and exiled and defamed and persecuted as a consequence, he preserved what he could of ethical Judaism and rejected the barbaric mythology of the Pentateuch. We have more reason to be grateful to him than to all the rabbis who have ever wailed or who ever will. Offered the first presidency of the State of Israel, Einstein declined because of his many qualms about the way Zionism was tending. This was much to the relief of David Ben-Gurion, who had nervously asked his cabinet, "What are we going to do if he says yes?" Wreathed in the widow's weeds of grief, the greatest Victorian of all is said to have appealed to her favourite Prime Minister to ask if he could produce one unanswerable argument for the existence of God. Benjamin Disraeli hesitated briefly before his queen, the woman whom he had made Empress of India, and replied, "The Jews, ma'am." It seemed to this worldly but superstitious political genius that the survival of the Jewish people, and their admirably stubborn adherence to their ancient rituals and narratives, showed the invisible hand at work. In fact, he was changing ships on a falling tide. Even as he spoke, the Jewish people were emerging from two different kinds of oppression. The first and most obvious was the ghettoization that had been imposed on them by ignorant and bigoted Christian authorities. This has been too well documented to need any elaboration from me. But the second oppression was self-imposed. Napoleon Bonaparte, for example, had with some reservations removed the discriminatory laws against Jews. He may well have hope for their financial support, but no matter. Yet when his armies invaded Russia, the rabbis urged their flock to rally to the side of the very Tsar who had been defaming and flogging and fleecing and murdering them. Better this Jew-baiting despotism, they said, than even a whiff of the unholy French Enlightenment. This is why the silly, ponderous melodrama in that Amsterdam synagogue was and remains so important. Even in a country as broad-minded as Holland, the elders had preferred to make common cause with Christian anti-Semites and other obscurantists, rather than permit the finest of their number to use his own free intelligence. When the walls of the ghettos fell, therefore, the collapse liberated the inhabitants from the rabbis as well as the Gentiles. There ensued a flowering of talent such as has seldom been seen in any epoch. A formerly stultified population proceeded to make immense contributions to medicine, science, law, politics, and the arts. The reverberations are still being felt. One need only instance Marx, Freud, and Einstein, though Isaac Babel, Arthur Koestler, Franz Kafka, Billy Wilder, Lenny Bruce, Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, Joseph Heller, and countless others are also the product of this dual emancipation. If one could nominate an absolutely tragic day in human history, it would be the occasion that is now commemorated by the vapid and annoying holiday known as Hanukkah. For once, instead of Christianity plagiarizing from Judaism, the Jews borrow shamelessly from Christians in the pathetic hope of a celebration that coincides with Christmas, which is itself a quasi-Christian annexation complete with burning logs and holly and mistletoe of a pagan Northland solstice originally illuminated by the Aurora Borealis. Here is the terminus to which banal multiculturalism has brought us. But it was nothing remotely multicultural that induced Judah Maccabeus to reconsecrate the temple in Jerusalem in 165 BC and to establish the date which the soft celebrants of Hanukkah now so emptily commemorate. The Maccabees, who founded the Hasmonean dynasty, were forcibly restoring Mosaic fundamentalism against the many Jews of Palestine and elsewhere who had become attracted by Hellenism. These true early multiculturalists had become bored by the law, offended by circumcision, interested in Greek literature, drawn by the physical and intellectual exercises of the gymnasium, and rather adept at philosophy. They could feel the pull exerted by Athens, even if only by way of Rome and by the memory of Alexander's time, and were impatient with the stark fear and superstition mandated by the Pentateuch. They obviously seemed too cosmopolitan to the votaries of the old temple, and it must have been easy to accuse them of dual loyalty when they agreed to have a temple of Zeus on the site where smoky and bloody altars used to propitiate the unsmiling deity of yore. At any rate, when the father of Judah Maccabeus saw a Jew about to make a Hellenic offering on the old altar, he lost no time in murdering him. Over the next few years of the Maccabean revolt, many more assimilated Jews were slain, or forcibly circumcised, or both, and the women, who had flirted with the new Hellenic dispensation, suffered even worse. Since the Romans eventually preferred the violent and dogmatic Maccabees to the less militarized and fanatical Jews who had shone in their togas in the Mediterranean light, the scene was set for the uneasy collusion between the old garb ultra-Orthodox Sanhedrin and the imperial governorate. This lugubrious relationship was eventually to lead to Christianity, yet another Jewish heresy, and thus ineluctably to the birth of Islam. we could have been spared the whole thing. No doubt there would still have been much foolishness and solipsism, but the connection between Athens and history and humanity would not have been so sundered, and the Jewish people might have been the carriers of philosophy instead of arid monotheism, and the ancient schools in their wisdom would not have become prehistoric to us. I once sat in the Knesset office of the late Rabbi Meir Kahana, a vicious racist and demagogue among whose supporters the mad Dr. Baruch Goldstein and other violent Israeli settlers were to be found. Kahana's campaign against mixed marriages and for the expulsion of all non-Jews from Palestine had earned him the contempt of many Israelis and diaspora Jews who compared his program to that of the Nuremberg laws in Germany. Kahana raved for a bit in response to this, saying that any Arab could remain if he converted to Judaism by a strictly halakha test, not a concession, admittedly, that Hitler would have permitted, but then became bored and dismissed his Jewish opponents as mere Hellenized riffraff. To this day, the Orthodox Jewish curse word for a heretic or apostate is apikoros, meaning follower of Epicurus. And he was correct in a formal sense. His bigotry had little to do with race and everything to do with faith. Sniffing this insanitary barbarian, I had a real pang about the world of light and colour that we had lost so long ago in the black-and-white nightmares of his dreary and righteous ancestors. The stench of Calvin and Torquemada and Bin Laden came from the dank, hunched figure whose couch-party goons patrolled the streets looking for Sabbath violations and unauthorized sexual contacts. Again, to take the metaphor of the Burgess Shale, here was a poisonous branch that should have been snapped off long ago or allowed to die out before it could infect any healthy growth with its junk DNA. But yet we still dwell in its unwholesome, life-killing shadow. And little Jewish children celebrate Hanukkah so as not to feel left out of the tawdry myths of Bethlehem, which are now being so harshly contested by the more raucous propaganda of Mecca and Medina.